it's well worth the trip, I hope. Now, I've got to lay down several little things for you. One is that if you know, perhaps I've written lots of books. And the most recent book that I've worked on is A Challenge to Evolution. But it's not based on scripture, it's based on biology. And it's based upon a problem that evolution has from a biology standpoint. And that is with the origin of sex from non-sex. Because according to evolutionary theory, the smallest organisms that were the very first organisms would have replicated themselves like cloning. It's just what you see is what you get. What you see is what you get over and over and over. It's the same thing. It's like a copy machine. Same thing. And so the DNA information that forms a particular organism would just sort of split, and it would be the same thing over and over again. And we've got that in our body. We've got those organisms that replicate by what is called mitosis. But then all of us are here because there were two parents who mated and divided their chromosomes in half to make us. And that's a process known as meiosis. But the problem is that if you don't have any information in the DNA coming from this exact copy stuff of mitosis, there's nothing to give you a male and a female in order to sexually reproduce by meiosis. Does that make any sense at all? So it's a big gap. And evolutionists know there's a gap there. They call it the queen of evolutionary problems. But instead of actually addressing the problem and solving the problem, they just paper over the problem, asking, well, why would sex have been advantageous in the process of evolution? Why would it have been selected by natural selection? Excuse me? How can you select something that doesn't what? Exist. If it doesn't exist, you can't select it. And they know that's a problem, but they ask the wrong question. Instead of how could that have happened, it's why would that be beneficial? But that always assumes something that's not existent to begin with. So that's the basic book that I have. But I've never done something crazy like I did do about a year ago. I woke up one morning with an idea to take my book and make a movie out of it. So I've never written a screenplay. I just decided, doesn't everybody write a screenplay? I'll just write a screenplay. So I wrote a screenplay. And then I decided to buy some books and read about how you write a screenplay. Not exactly the right order, was it? Well, sort of a gap in my process as well. But I was just overjoyed that from a mechanical standpoint, I'd kind of done it. You know, you're supposed to have three acts. Did you know that? Every movie has three acts. And they're all about 2 hours long, so a page per minute. And they tell you that the first 30 pages, the first 30 minutes of your film, needs to be act one. And then there has to be something that triggers you into act two, which is about an hour long. And then something that triggers you into act three, which is another 30 minutes to wrap things up. One author even said you need 14 scenes in act one, 14 in act three, and 28 in act two. And I was pretty bang on. I was really happy with myself. So from a mechanical standpoint, I'd kind of lucked into doing what I was supposed to be doing. But my story wasn't real great. And Ruth said she wasn't going to buy her dress for the premiere just yet. So I sent it around to a whole bunch of people, paid one guy some money to, you know, help me get it to the next level. And so I've gone through draft after draft after draft, and all my friends are saying this is not good, not good, not good. Getting better, getting better. Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's getting there. So anyway, it's been through a process of evolution. It's been slowly evolving. I say all of that to introduce you to a passage in Isaiah chapter 51. And I'll begin reading in verse 17 in a moment, and I'll be reading from the New International Version, which I don't know how many of you have that, but in any event, it occurred to me that this is a text that gives us an overview of the greatest story ever told. An overview, even though it's talking about Israel and Israel being in exile and then the promise of restoration. In the middle of it, it talks about the life of Christ, and that's where it has a nice fit with what you were going to study today. And in fact, since you're having a survey of the life of Christ, this is sort of a nutshell of that survey. And so bear with me, please, as I turn this passage into a screenplay. And the reason I'm doing it is because at the end, there's some things that I think we can learn from a screenplay that we couldn't learn otherwise that could have some real application to our lives. But just bear with me. Act one, with the opening scene, you have the children of Israel in exile. And so you think of them as slaves. And just think about all those movies where you've seen these long rows of slaves with stones on their back or something like that. And they're just in a stupor. They're barely awake, but they're just, you know, that kind of a scene and the dramatic music that starts the film that way. And here comes the opening scene. Awake, awake, rise up, O Jerusalem. You who have drunk from the hand of the Lord the cup of his wrath. You who have drained it to its dregs, the goblet that makes men stagger. And here they are staggering under the weight of their oppression in captivity. So the call to them is, wake up. Wake up, something's about to happen. Now, in my screenplay, I have a voiceover, and I see this in lots of movies where there's a narrator that sort of talks over what you're seeing there and tells you what's going on. And so here's the voiceover of the narrator. Of all the sons she, Israel, bore, there was none to guide her. Of all the sons she reared, there was none to take her by the hand. These double calamities have come upon you. Who can comfort you? Ruin and destruction, famine and sword, who can console you? Okay, at the very beginning of every screenplay and movie, you've got to have a hook, don't you? You've got to hook the audience with something. So the hook is, who's going to rescue Israel out of this exile? Who's going to come along and save the heroine who's been tied to the railroad tracks? Who's our protagonist? Who's our hero that's going to come on the scene? That's the hook, because we need somebody to rescue Israel from captivity. Skip on down here. See, I have taken out of your hand the cup that made you stagger. From that cup, the goblet of my wrath, you will never drink again. So it's predicting rescue. It's predicting a coming comfort. In fact, it says, I will put it into the hands of your tormentors who said to you, fall prostrate that we may walk over you, and so forth. It's not only a rescue, but as with so many movies, and we delight in it, when there is a reversal of fortune, when the bad guy gets his. Tell me a story in Scripture where the bad guy is upended in the very same way he intended to upend somebody else. Haman in the story of Esther. So that's a reversal of fortune, and we're going, yeah, he got his. Well, it's a great movie. It's a great scene. So God is saying to Israel, not only will I rescue you, but the punishment that you have been under by your oppressors will be under a similar kind of punishment. Now, skip over to chapter 52, verse maybe, I don't know. I'm going out of the narrated Bible, and I don't have any verses in my margin. So would that be verse 4 maybe? For this is what the sovereign Lord says. At first my people went down to Egypt to live. Lately, Assyria has oppressed them. Now, what in the world is this about in a movie? Well, in a movie many times, and I've got it in my little screenplay, there's a flashback. There's a flashback. So the flashback sometimes can explain something that's going to happen in the future. That happens here. At first, my people went down to Egypt to live. Lately, Assyria has oppressed them. Why talk about Egypt in the same context as Assyria? Pardon? Oppression, yes, but also, more importantly, what happened in Egypt? What did God do to the children of Israel when they were in Egypt?
Bring them out.
He brought them out, didn't he? So where are they now? Under oppression. What's he going to do? Bring them out. See? So you've got this flashback to show you what's going to happen in the future. It's sort of back to the future, speaking of films. That's very helpful, and it's encouraging to us to think that if God did it once, he can do it again. Now, every good movie has a B story or a backstory. In my movie, actually, I should tell you the plot of my movie, shouldn't I? The plot of my movie is that there is a very popular evolution writer and biology professor at an Ivy League university, let's call it Harvard. Some of his students start asking him hard questions about this gap between asexual replication and sexual reproduction. He starts thinking through everything he ever knew about evolution, and finally comes out of the closet at a scientific conference and says, my colleagues, sorry, Houston, we have a problem. Evolution has a fatal flaw, and we should recognize it, admit it, and go from there. Well, that doesn't set well with them. It's kind of like losing an election. So they strip him of tenure and fire him, and his life goes downhill. Well, that's okay for a story, but that's not what's going to get Ruth to the premiere with a new dress. So I have to come up with a backstory, and my backstory is the family life, the home life of my hero protagonist. And he's married to a bright young career woman, but they've been wanting to have children. So the very day that he has this class on sexual reproduction, at which he's asked these embarrassing questions by this bright student, he goes home and she says, we're pregnant. The doctor just called and the baby we've been wanting for so long, we're going to have. And so he's all excited about that, but it raises some beginning of life questions, and that's good. And then we meet his family. Now, he's Jewish. He's irreligious. His parents obviously are Jewish, but they're funny and hilarious. But his dad gets cancer and eventually dies, which will raise many of the end-of-life questions and the nature of a soul. Could evolution produce a soul? No. Could it produce an afterlife in heaven? No, it couldn't do that because it's strictly material. So, the backstory. Well, here in verse 7 of chapter 52 of Isaiah, we have a little bit of a backstory. And the backstory is not the story of Israel directly, but about the prophets of Israel. How beautiful on the mountains are the feet of those who bring good news, who proclaim peace, who bring good tidings, who proclaim salvation, who say to Zion, your God reigns. And because your God reigns, he can do things that no one else can do, like get you out of captivity. Well, so the B story here in this overview of the greatest story ever told is the role of the prophets to foretell what's going on in the future and to give hope and encouragement. But the B story always has to tie in with the A story, the main story. How does the B story about how beautiful are the feet of prophets, how does that tie in with the main story? Who's coming? Christ, the prophet, not just a prophet, but the prophet. And it's this the prophet who is going to proclaim to Zion, your God reigns, and here I am in person to prove it to you. So it's an interesting interplay between the role of prophets and the role of the prophet who is coming. Now, this will be the shortest little passage maybe that I read, but the most important. Let's begin reading in verse 11. And in verses 11 and 12, I want you to make a mental note that this is the most important thing I'll be talking about later on. This is why you're supposed to hang in with me on something that seems weird, but it'll come back and it'll be really important. Depart, depart, go out from there. Touch no unclean thing. Come out from it and be pure. And I think especially you who carry the vessels of the Lord, you who are spiritual leaders in Israel. But come out from it and touch no unclean thing. Protagonist, the hero of the story, is going to deliver you. But it won't be his work completely, because you have a role to play in this story as well. And your role is to become pure people. Your role is to be transformed, because you have been unfaithful and you need to learn to be faithful. You have been impure and you need to learn to be pure. That's your role. That's your supporting role in this story. The main role is the one who's coming to redeem, but you have a role yourself. And this will also be a point that I'll make later on. But you will not leave in haste or go in flight, for the Lord will go before you. The God of Israel will be your rear guard. You will not leave in haste. This transformation that is being called upon is something that cannot happen suddenly. It doesn't happen in a moment. It doesn't happen in a single scene. It happens over a prolonged period of time. So, what this is known as is the character arc, A-R-C, like a rainbow, arc. It's a character arc, moving from one point in a person's life to another point in a person's life. And it's that character arc that I want to talk about as we move forward. Now, all of this sets us up for Act 2, the long act. And in Act 2, we have the arrival of our protagonist and hero. And of course, that is Christ, the one about whom your survey, his life, is all about. But it's not who we expect. When he walks onto the scene, he is not our Indiana Jones wearing his fedora, as someone I know is wearing his fedora these days. He doesn't come in looking like Indiana Jones. Classy guy, well, that didn't apply to you, but classy guy, handsome devil. You women might swoon over some actor that is your favorite hunk out there that comes onto the screen, and you immediately recognize him. Ooh, wow, he must be the hero, because he's got the white hat and the greatest horse, and he just is a cutting figure. But we know now, because we've read this story so many times, we know now that he doesn't look like that. See, my servant will act wisely. He will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. But just as there were many who were appalled at him, his appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any man, and his form marred beyond human likeness. Doesn't sound like any hero we know. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering, like one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised. We esteemed him not. You wouldn't put his face up on the playbill. Nobody would ever show up. You know, for those of you who are much older, Clark Gable. I mean, you know, come on. Give me someone to entice me into the theater. It doesn't look like that. Ruth and I went to a production of Beauty and the Beast recently, which is kind of interesting because we ourselves were the Beauty and the Beast. But the Beast, of course, he'd been so disfigured that who would have guessed he would have been such a warm and tender person underneath? And so in screenwriting, they sometimes call that a shape shifter, that there's an actor that comes on the scene and immediately his shape doesn't look right, but he starts shifting that shape and it makes for a very intriguing kind of character. Well, that apparently is what Jesus was. He was not a hero because he was a look-good hero. He was a hero because of his character. Now, in real estate, it's always what? Location, location, location. In screenwriting, it's always, do you know? Conflict, conflict, conflict. There's no story that moves us unless there's conflict. There's no movie that moves us unless there's conflict. And so, what do we have in the Gospels? The relationship between Jesus and those who were the Pharisees and scribes and so forth, conflict, 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 over and over again. And they're trying to run him out of town, they're trying to stone him, over and over again. Conflict, conflict, conflict. Verse 4 of Isaiah 53. Surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows, yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him, and afflicted. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. He was oppressed and afflicted. I'm skipping a bit. Yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as sheep before her shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. Conflict, conflict, conflict. A full 1 hour in the Gospels of conflict. 30 minutes to build up to it, and then an hour of conflict. And you're just almost worn out by the end of Act 2 because of all the conflict that's going on. And what's so important about that is that it relates to our lives. Because what do we have in our lives? Conflict, conflict, conflict. Things break around the house, and you think, Lord, I could be busier saving souls than fixing a faucet. But if the faucet's working well, are we saving souls? I don't know. But conflict, conflict, conflict. There's disease. There's death of family members. There's marital strife. There's political strife in our country. It's just conflict, conflict, conflict. Are you weary of conflict? I am. Really, I am. I'm just really weary of it. Now, at the end of Act 2, we have a triggering incident. And you always need a triggering incident as you move from one act to another. The triggering incident is what today's class was to be about, the arrest and trial of Jesus. So he's arrested, and you're thinking, oh no. Now see, we're familiar with the ending of the story, but if we hadn't watched this movie before, we'd be thinking, oh no, he's been arrested. Oh no, there's a trial. Oh no, this trial is not even fair. It's rigged. I don't know if you've ever heard those words before, but it's rigged. It's a rigged trial. In fact, it is a rigged trial. So it just leaves you gasping. What's going to happen here? That's the triggering incident that leads you into Act 3. All right. But in Act 3, where we think everything's going to kind of come to a conclusion, any good movie always has one last moment. The hero's in trouble. He dies. We think. Well, by oppression and judgment he was taken away, and who can speak of his descendants? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was stricken. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. Now, in a normal movie, it looks like the guy's died. I watched one just the other night where you just assume he died, but no. There's a resurrection. He comes back. But hardly any movie has him in the grave. I mean, he looks like he's dead, but they don't bury him, do they? And then have him come back to life. So here we have the classic last struggle and then the resurrection. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. Wow, there is that death we think, and of course it is a death, but there is also a resurrection. And every movie has a symbolic, every good movie has a symbolic resurrection after the protagonist seemingly has died a great death. And then one of the things that doesn't always happen in movies, but it almost always happens in the great myths that were like the early movies of long ago, the hero always seems to bring back a gift from the battle. He's gone off, he's fought the battle, we think he's died, he's been resurrected, and he brings back a gift. What gift do you think of in myths? What is brought back? What is brought back?
Treasures.
Treasures or? The Holy Grail. The head of the beast. There you go. The head of the beast and the treasures, the Holy Grail, and so forth. And so when he comes back, therefore I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong. So he brings back the gift of what for us? Life. Right. And every movie, at the end of the movie, there's got to be a final resolution. In the same way that any good music always has to have a final resolution. When we have our singing this afternoon, just think about the hymns and how they end. They don't end in some kind of discordant, strange way. They always kind of bring the chord together, and that's called a resolution in music. Same thing in a movie. And so he bore the sins of many and made intercession for the transgressors. Therefore, there's resolution. Okay, now, one of the books that I read after I wrote my screenplay was a book called A Writer's Journey, based upon Joseph Campbell's work primarily. Anyone know of Joseph Campbell? He talked about myths, and he explored universal myths, and they all contain the same thing, he says. You see, if you hear one myth or see one myth, you've seen them all. Harry Potter, Star Wars,
Fellowship of the
Rings. It's all the same. It's all the same story. It's all the same story. So in this book, and I wish I had it with me. I didn't bring it with me, not knowing I didn't know I was going to do this. But if I could take you to a passage that talks about the death of the protagonist and his resurrection, and it reads almost as if I were to say here, baptism by immersion in a stream symbolizes the death and resurrection of the hero and washes away the smell of death in battle. That's almost an exact quote from this book. Isn't that amazing? I mean, Joseph Campbell sort of wrote something like this. It wasn't Alexander Campbell. It was Joseph Campbell. And actually, it wasn't Joseph. It was the writer of this book. But just the picture of it. He says the picture of it is what it's all about. That we have an old man in a former world, then something happens, and there's a new man in a new world. And then this book asks the question, now, what's the character going to do once this thing takes place? Is he going to act according to who he was before this act, or is he going to act in a different way after this act? Isn't that amazing? And so he starts talking about the character arc. Remember I told you that? That's the most important thing I want you to think about, the character arc. Because the character arc, when we're talking about Israel, Israel needed to get away from its unfaithfulness and be faithful, get away from its impurity and be pure. That was their character arc. And it was going to take how long? Overnight? No, we said it was not going to happen suddenly. And in this book for screenwriters, it says one of the things that fledgling screenwriters like you, Lagarde, do is you try to have a character arc that's too short. You try to transform someone in one scene as opposed to across the full length of the movie. And it never works. It never works. And it got me to thinking, what one scene in your life and mine do we look to say that we have been transformed from the old man to the new man, putting off the old man and putting on the new man? What one single scene is that? Baptism. Baptism. And it's usually done at a point in time when we were very young and maybe had not experienced the impurities of the world in a way that would even allow us to make a transformation in that moment, in that scene. And so the question for us, I think, is if we have a whole fellowship of believers who have been baptized but not transformed, what is the product of that? Is that a church that's not evangelistic? Is that a church that's impure? Is that a church that goes through the motions of ritual but isn't truly spiritual? You see, that really hit me hard because I know how hard it is to write a character arc. If you start off as a good guy and you end up as a good guy, that's not much of a character arc. It's a flat line. And if you start off with a bad guy and you end up with a bad guy, that's not much of a character arc either. What is being asked of us is too much in one scene. the act of going down in the water is an exciting time because it symbolizes the death and the resurrection that every good movie, every good story talks about. But the problem is, if we have it in one scene and that's all there is, has it really affected us? And I'll be very honest with you, candid with you, that at the age of 71, I look back on my character arc, and I do see somewhat of an arc in some ways, but I also have a flat line in part of my life. In part of my life, there's absolutely been very little improvement. And I'm brutally honest about that, and I think you should be brutally honest about your own self. Is there a part of you that has had really no character arc that's not changed? That just nags at you over and over again, and you haven't changed it yet? But you're kind of relying on that one scene. Yeah, I was, and I am considered righteous because of what Christ did on the cross. But now that is problematic, I think. Is baptism my only arc? If so, it's not much of an arc, particularly if we were baptized at a very early age. And then the writer of the book says that heroes always have interesting flaws. A really good hero always has flaws that we can relate with. Well, do you know what I find to be the most intriguing thing about the storyline of a screenplay? This is the greatest story ever told. It's the greatest story ever told. We talk about it that way. People who are not even believers talk about the greatest story ever told. And when we think in terms of a survey of the life of Jesus Christ, we say, you know, that's the greatest story ever told. But what is interesting about the protagonist and the hero in that story? You tell me.
No flaws.
No flaws. No flaws. In the greatest story ever told, there's no flaws in our hero. There's no character arc. He didn't start off flawed and become not flawed. His life was not dead and resurrected from a moral standpoint. And we're told, unless your main protagonist has flaws and a character arc, you have no story. Lagarde, your story isn't great because you don't take this guy from being some creepy bum to some spiritual hero. And yet, the protagonist in the greatest story ever told has no character arc. It's flat line. The difference between his flat line, however, and my flat line is all the difference in the world. Because my flat line has to do with sin that's unaddressed. His flat line is that he didn't have any sin to address. So why do you think that we call this a great story? Why is it that it is a great story if it violates the most fundamental rule of storytelling? Why is that? I'm going to open up for discussion. Why is it? It's not written by man, but that doesn't change the nature of the story itself as to who the author is.
John Eldridge wrote a little book called Epic. His whole point was all of our stories and our movies imitate that story in the sense that there's, and you touched upon this, good versus evil. So that was his main point, is the good versus evil that we see in every movie that we listen to this movie is in this story. Now, to touch upon your question, I guess the apt response would be this protagonist in this greatest story took upon our flat line.
Well, he did that. He made our flat line redemptive. but
still not getting to
the point of how his lack of flaws makes this story so good.
Self-sacrifice.
He does that. Every good hero does that, though.
Yeah.
Every myth has done that.
His character arc gave opportunity for our character arc, even though his was flat for a different reason.
Gave opportunity. Let's stretch that for just a minute. It gave opportunity, and it also gave what?
Hope.
Hope. And?
It's always hoping a good story.
Always hoping a good story, and he gives us hope that we could be better than we are, that our character arc could be a better arc. And also, he not only just encourages us and gives us hope, but he gives us proof that it could happen, that we can be better. Yeah, and no other myth really does that. No other myth really gives us that kind of a thing. There's self-sacrifice. They give us hope that good triumphs over evil. But no one ever gives us that perfect character by which our arc can be compared, and then gives us the hope that, well, if somebody could do it, even if it was the Son of God, if somebody could be sinless, then maybe we too could be better at it. And so then when I start looking at my flatline, the part of me that's flatline, it rebukes me, it shames me, it encourages me, it gives me hope that I could actually and ought to actually work harder at getting that part of my character arc in better shape. So that's where he's different. And I find the C.S. Lewis connection interesting here, that C.S. Lewis had his good friend who wrote Tolkien. Tolkien and Lewis both loved myths. And they both wrote myths. But until C.S. Lewis talked with Tolkien about the kind of myths that were out there, he was not convinced of anything about the scripture until Tolkien said, this is the one myth that is what? True. The one myth that is true. And surely C.S. Lewis must have said, yes, I can recognize that because this protagonist did not have a character arc, and all the others do. And not only that, but historically, it is true. And if it is true, then I can base my life on that. So I know this is a bit of a strange way to get to a couple of interesting points, but I hope that we get the point about, first of all, our lives and examining our lives through this character arc. And I'll ask you to think one more time about your own character arc. What is it like? Especially those of us who are older, who've had a long time to get our character arc together. And then secondly, the nature of a protagonist like Jesus, who had no flaws. And what does that do for us lately?